Well, first of all, happy Monday. Oh, happy Indigenous Persons Day. I think that's what they're calling it in some cities. I sort of support that idea. Connecticut will be the last state to have Indigenous Persons Day instead of Columbus Day. But for those of you who celebrate it. First of all, I also have to say Kyan Wolf is not here today. What happened was that she was on her phone. She was distracted. She was looking at her phone because she was trying to work out her football bet on FanDuel. And somebody slid into her and broke her leg. So she really kind of has both of the big stories today that we're going to be covering are contained in her story. We're going to talk first about, let me just tell you a quick story. So I'm coming back from church on Sunday, and I happen to be a Green Bay Packers fan. I'm one of those old school, conventional, traditional, stale people who actually roots for a football team as opposed to spending a lot of money on fantasy football betting. So I'm a Green Bay Packers fan, and the game's coming up at 1, and it's 12:30. I'm on the road, so I turn on ESPN radio thinking, well, they'll have some kind of pregame show on, pregame analysis of all the games that are coming up and everything, so and maybe they'll say something about the Packers. Well, silly me. They don't have anything like that. They have a show called Fantasy Focus, and all they do on this show is their experts sit there and tell you, you know, which tight end to start if you have a choice between Witten and Gates or something like that. That's all they're doing. That's it. That's the whole show. It's unbelievably boring. It just sort of churns over and over again. And you realize this whole thing, fantasy sports betting, has taken the place of traditional sports watching, or it's crowding out a lot of the old traditional sports watching. And it's crowding out the journalism that used to go along with traditional sports watching, too. Instead of finding out, you know, things about the games, all they were talking about is what people should do with their crappy little fantasy teams. Anyway, I have a very, very dark view of this whole industry. We're going to spend the first segment today talking about fantasy sports sites. And then the second segment, we'll be talking about something that actually happened on the field of play, of all things. And that'll be the slide. That's, of course, the Jay Sutley slide from the Mets game the other night. The next game between those two teams is tonight. There's an awful lot of machinations and drama going on. So in our second segment today, we'll be talking about Will Leach. No, we are not a sports program, but today we are. Sort of, anyway. So let me tell you about who's here with us. In the studio with me is Sarah Porras. She is a lawyer in Hartford, specializing in consumer protection law. You may have seen a piece she wrote about the Hartford Current, wrote for the Hartford Current about fantasy sports players, people who play on these sites. And also joining us is Diana Moskovitz. She is a staff writer for Deadspin. And she's been writing about how this industry came into existence, how it came to be. And the story that she is going to tell you is sort of everything that you don't want to hear and everything that makes you feel kind of bad and scummy and dirty about how government works anyway. So, but Sarah Porras, I'm going to start with you. Just for people who don't know anything about this, who barely understand what it is we're talking about, who somehow or other haven't paid that much attention to the 60,000 advertisements, according to Deadspin, that have aired this year alone for these two major fantasy sites. What is it that we're talking about? How does this work?
Well, we're talking about going online and choosing. You know, I haven't logged in and done this myself. I think any guest caller could call in and say this is exactly how it's done. Yeah. But you go in and you pick a team based on who your favorite players are overall and the positions they play. And apparently it's NFL, NBA, Major League Baseball, depending on the season, hockey. Mm-hmm. And you have to spend money. You have to put in your credit card. Then you get to start playing. Now, they tease you, as the ads will say, by giving you a few hundred dollars worth of credit to play. But of course, you have to register and put in your credit card. So you're going to inevitably spend some money. And I believe it's pay per game and then pay per player above the credit, because you have to pick your players. And the most popular players cost more, because the ones who are more likely to do well in a game are the more popular, popular players who you have to pay more to put on your team.
Tucker Roger, are you a guest on the show now, or have you just...
No.
Oh, you have no... She has no headphones. Oh, okay. See, I believe in just telling the audience what's going on here. There you go. There's the problem.
Much better.
Much better? Yeah, you can hear now. So what we know is that this is really big business. So last week, not this past weekend, but last week, these two big companies, DraftKings and FanDuel, both posted their first profitable Sundays of the season. And the numbers go like this. They gave out $39.8 million in winnings, but they took in about $43.6 million. So just do a little bit of mental math about this, okay? So it's a 17-week football season plus playoffs leading up to Super Bowl, and that's just football. This is happening in lots of other places. So you don't, you know, just, you know, on the back of an envelope, you can see this is it's a nascent industry. It's brand new. It's already, in terms of the handle, you know, it's got to be somewhere around $1 billion, if not more. Just looking at it that way. And before we get to Diana, Sarah, one thing that you want people to know about this is there's sort of a power law here, right? That I think it's 91% of the winnings go to 1.5% of the players. So if you're watching those commercials where these guys get all teary-eyed because they've suddenly become incredibly rich and are about to leave their nebbishy lives, there are things you don't understand.
Right. I believe the ones who are playing 24/7, the ones who have developed algorithms and software to beat the games, the ones with inside information, they're the ones who are going to win. And I'm afraid that what I'm going to start seeing, especially in my practice, is people who have maxed out credit cards under the belief and understanding that they can actually beat this game because it's pitched as a game of skill. That's how they get around the online gambling prohibitions. And so the more people who believe that their skill from watching games every Sunday, from being a huge sports fan, whatever your sport is, they're going to log in and they're going to say, well, if I just keep charging more, eventually I will win and I'll be the guy with that big check. But what they aren't showing you on the commercial is that guy is probably an employee of one of the two major online gambling sites, online fantasy sites, and he probably put in a couple million or many thousands of dollars on his own in order to win back some money. And, you know, the return is tiny. Even if you do play and play and play, the return is small. You might as well do something that isn't addictive and isn't gambling. It's much less risky with your money. And I'm afraid people are going to do it with their available credit on their credit cards.
So, I mean, the irony here is that it kind of is a game of skill in the worst possible way, in that people who have an awful lot more sort of computing firepower and knowledge and stuff like that have a huge advantage over people who don't. But before we even get to that, Diana Moskovitz, maybe you can tell us, like, I thought sports betting was illegal. I am a Packers fan. If I wanted to bet on the Packers and wanted them to cover the spread, and not that I ever make any effort to know about things like that, I wouldn't have any idea how to do it, because to the best of my knowledge, Diana, you can't bet on sports. So where did this thing come from?
This thing came from a bill that passed in 2006. The proper title had to do with unlawful internet gambling enforcement. And you'll hear a lot of people talk about something called a carve-out, which is that this got tacked on at the end of a bill and, you know, the waning hours of a session that had to do with security at U.S. seaports and preventing terrorism there. It got tacked on the very end, and it outlawed gambling, sports gambling on the Internet, because Congress can oversee the Internet, and it's part of interstate commerce. But it has something called a carve-out. A lot of people will just call it the carve-out, that basically exempted fantasy sports, that said, you know, as with legislation, you're setting a lot of definitions, and what it was saying, the definition of a bet or a wager, which, of course, is part of gambling, it made sure to specifically exempt the participation in any fantasy or simulation sports game. That's the exact language for the bill. And it goes on for several paragraphs to define all these things, and pretty much what happened in these cases is they left an opening for fantasy sports, and the market went to the opening. And if you read how fantasy sports is defined in a carve-out, you can pretty much see how FanDuel and DraftKings operate.
And yes, it does. I mean, in other words, this legislation, which, as you say, is tucked into a piece of counterterrorism legislation that begins about seaport security and stuff like that, and suddenly they're talking about this, and they are describing it in the letter of the law pretty much the way it works. It wasn't as though someone was trying to imagine something that didn't exist or that couldn't exist or might someday exist. I mean, they're basically just describing how these sites work, and they're describing them as legal. They're carve-outs. They don't get acted against the way other kinds of online sports betting would. And one of the things that you reported, Diana, is that it's kind of interesting who wanted this. Because we know in general that most professional sports leagues aren't too crazy about sports betting, the other kind of sports betting, what we will now refer to apparently as the bad kind of sports betting. But somehow or other, the NFL really wanted this thing. Now, why was that?
Oh, yes. The NFL really, really wanted this. I should point out that eventually all the major sports leagues very openly were endorsing this. But by all accounts in the press coverage at the time, this was described as, you know, heavily lobbied for by the NFL, NFL-sponsored. This is the NFL's creation, by some accounts. Why they wanted it, the NFL has never spoken directly to why they lobbied for the carve-out. When they were lobbying for the legislation overall, they just said it was to prevent internet gambling, and they talked about the integrity of the game, which they love to talk about, and the importance of making sure that everything was on the up and up. After the legislation got passed, when it came out that the carve-out was included, immediately excluding fantasy sports, no one really wanted to talk about it. None of the lawmakers who worked on it talked to the Associated Press. The New York Post had some great reporting, but it all involved anonymous sources. And why they went along with this, you know, no one has ever seemingly really given an honest answer, although the money sure points to the fact that the NFL makes a lot of money off of fantasy, both in some ways directly. You can go to NFL.com and sign up for fantasy football, and indirectly with how many people watch the game because they want to see how their fantasy players are doing.
Right. So to me, this is the key to it all. Yeah. I mean, obviously, all the teams are going into their individual partnerships with some of these companies, but also the TV eyeballs, they're such an all-important driver of money. So think about it. Imagine that you're a fan of one particular team, and they're terrible. They're the Detroit Lions or... Well, that's too extreme an example. Let's say it's the Redskins because there's a better tie-in. So the Redskins have been kind of chronically terrible. They're 2-3 right now. They're probably not going to go to the playoffs. But if you're a fan of the Redskins and you're participating in fantasy football, you have a lot of incentive to watch football on television. Even if you're not watching the Redskins, you have other reasons to watch games. And you even have a reason to go buy a ticket to watch your hideous Redskins because there's one of the fantasy sports teams I think either has or is about to have its own lounge there in the stadium. So if you can't stand to watch the Redskins anymore, even though they're your team, you could go to this lounge and see how your fantasy team is doing and hang out with other gambling addicts. And so, I mean, obviously, the ways in which the NFL can better monetize their already highly monetizable product are they're almost endless when you think about it. Now, Sarah, one of the things, and Diana kind of alluded to this, whenever there's an argument in favor of something like this, whether it's this kind of fantasy site gambling or the arguments that go on all the time about legalized sports betting or any kind of legalized betting. And significantly, and we can talk about this, the gaming industry is the one player that so far has been kind of shut out of this. They're on the sidelines screaming their heads off because they want legalized sports betting, and instead it's this fantasy thing. But either way, the argument is always, we can regulate it. We can monitor it better this way. I mean, the leagues are saying that about fantasy betting. Like, if it happens this way, it can be better monitored. It can be understood. But what we found out so far is it's not being monitored at all. I mean, you definitely have a more monitored activity if you take the same amount of money down to a blackjack table at one of the casinos. Not that that's a great idea, but it seems, from what I can tell, the regulation of that is much tighter than what we're seeing here.
That looks to be the case. And so the comparison to actually walking into a casino or sitting down at a slot machine is identical. And what's a shame that I've been, you know, told since I wrote the op-ed last week was that you're taking something that used to be social, used to be fairly regulated in and of itself, because these fantasy leagues would be at your workplace or among your family members. You weren't spending a ton of money on it. I mean, some people could go overboard, but a few $100 is different from a few $1,000s. And it was social. It was limited. You couldn't do hundreds and hundreds of these because you'd run out of family or coworkers to do them with. So what it's doing is it's turning us, instead of going social and outward with it and it being kind of a fun thing, just kind of a game, and the thrill of maybe winning at the end of the season or at the end of the weekend, is being transformed into an individual thing. I always picture people at home in dark rooms lit by their monitors, you know, and overnight, in the middle of the night, doing these things. And if you weren't addicted or didn't know you had an addiction before, I think this is it really can play into that. And that's the pattern I'm afraid I'm going to start seeing.
Right. And I mean, when I say this is not regulated, really, although there's a little fine print thing with the ads saying what the average actual winning is, which is like $22 or something, I mean, what you really don't understand is who you're playing against, how many more advantages they, even if they're not engaging in insider trading, how many more advantages they have. They have the people who are really good at this, the 1.5% power law winners in this have computer programs that just allow them to crunch data faster, make changes in their lineup faster, respond to situations faster than a human being could. So you, the human being, it's sort of like you're day trading head to head in a zero sum game against Goldman Sachs, you, the average person. So, but this is like not being revealed to people. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back with more of Sarah Porras, more of Diana Moskovitz from Deadspin after this.
Running back to, hey, Jack, you need a quarterback or you could be screwed. It's the reason I'm cheesing and feelings are fine. It's fantasy football time. Fantasy football time.
All right, we're back. It's a very sports-heavy edition of The Scramble today. We're talking right now about fantasy betting sites. We'll be talking about The Slide. I don't really have to tell you what The Slide is. We'll be talking about that in the final segment here today. Joining us right now is Diana Moskovitz. She's a staff writer for Deadspin. Sarah Porras is a lawyer in Hartford specializing in consumer protection law. We're talking, as I say, about these sites like DraftKings and FanDuel, and there's a lot more to say about this. Diana, you know, we talked or alluded to the fact that a lot of these companies have signed partnerships with Major League Baseball, the NBA, the NHL, and various individual NFL teams. They also are bombarding television viewers these days with as I said, 60,000 airings of commercials so far this year and rising. But the other thing that Deadspin's covered a bit is just the hand-in-glove relationship between some of these companies and media companies. They're backed by media companies like Comcast and NBC, and they seem to have an almost inextricable relationship with ESPN. I mean, it's even, I mean, I was astonished today that the New York Times, which is doing some pretty hard-nosed reporting about some of the liabilities of these companies, not that they have any kind of business relationship with DraftKings and FanDuel, but right next on their website, right next to the hard-nosed reporting is all this like advice from the New York Times about how to manage your fantasy team. They've got a couple of savants and experts there to tell you how to do this better. But the media component of this, Diana, is pretty big from what I can gather.
Oh, yeah, it's huge. It's actually, you know, some people say part of why this is all finally blowing up. My colleague Barry Petrescu wrote a really great piece about how part of what happened this year was just everyone got so sick of those ads. You know, I mean, I'm a football fan. You're a football fan. We all knew Daily Fantasy was here. It didn't just pop up, but it was, you know, a banner ad here, a TV commercial there. This year, both companies, for reasons I don't completely know, it doesn't really matter. They both just went in. They went in hard. They were making huge ad buys. They were everywhere. There was one day I was watching football, and I swear on every commercial break, no matter which station I was on, I saw those ads, and it just got annoying and it got frustrating. And in that sense, it was only a matter of time until someone made a mistake and everyone was going to pounce on it because everyone was just really mad at them and really frustrated and really over it. And that's a part of it too. Everyone was just sick of seeing them.
Yeah, I'm not only sick of the ads, I'm sick of Ed Norton's entire acting career because, I mean, he's on half of those ads. By the way, if you're involved in this in some way and you want to communicate with us, you can call in 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. You can also tweet at us as people are doing, at WNPR Colin. You know, Diana was saying, Sarah, you know, why this year? Why so many ads? One possibility, we got a tweet from Paul about this. One possibility is that they know that people like you who are writing op-eds, who are consumer protection attorneys, who may be in touch with their elected representatives in Congress. We have people like Richard Blumenthal who are already getting interested. One reason to do this is it is the Wild West right now. It's not very well regulated, as Paul is suggesting, and this makes sense to me. Get as many new members as you can before there are laws.
That's right. It's online gambling. It's very ambiguous. I was doing some research, too, about Connecticut's laws about gambling and gambling online, and they defer to a Department of Justice opinion letter, and there isn't a specific carve-out in the Connecticut General Statutes against online gambling. And the one case I've ever handled was a client who had a high credit card debt, and we were trying to use the defense that he incurred the debt doing something or that was the loan was given for an unlawful purpose, and the best we could do was really negotiate his debt down to a lower fraction than what he would have had to pay had they gotten a judgment against him. So it really is insidious. It's very hard to help people and protect people from their own addiction, their own participation, especially when they use their credit card. And that's when I come in, is when someone has maxed out credit cards and has stopped paying their mortgage because of it and other bills, and they seek legal help.
Do you think? Well, let me just describe the insider trading for a second, because the insider trading is a big part of this. So one of the things that has sort of basically been discovered is that people who – in other words – well, first of all, let me back up. In order to have these sites, they had to hire people who were really good at running these games. And it turns out the people who are really good at running these games and figuring out, you know, how to operate them are the same people who are really good at playing them. So that's kind of who they hired. They hired a lot of people who are good at playing these kinds of games. And then it turns out they could continue to play these games. And sometimes what they do is they use information that they got at the site where they work, DraftKings, and they go and play on FanDuel or the reverse. It's helpful to have a lot of information about how the betting is going, because the way that you win in some cases is to bet on or start or use players that a lot of other people aren't using. If you're using the same player, using the same quarterback that everybody else is, it's hard to make a lot of money with Aaron Rodgers because everybody wants to use Aaron Rodgers because he's a great quarterback. So if you have that information about players that aren't being used as much, you have a better chance of making those big winnings. But the other thing that I read today that was astonishing in the New York Times coverage of this, they describe a guy named Madison Calvert. He's a regular player on these sites. He's at a party hosted by DraftKings, one of the two major players here, for people like Madison Calvert, who are probably throwing a lot of money away. So just like any other gambling operation, they want to give you free drinks and make you feel pretty good about yourself. And he realizes that one of the executives from DraftKings can look at his phone and know what he, Madison Calvert, regular player, is doing. This guy says to him, oh, you know what? You're starting the wrong pitcher there. Too many other people are starting that pitcher. Don't use that pitcher. And then he realizes, and I'll quote from the New York Times, that he, Calvert, who's 29 years old, had repeatedly been challenged for head-to-head play in another game on the website FanDuel by a Rick Sawyer. After checking a search engine, Calvert said he found out that Sawyer was actually a business planning manager at DraftKings. I could only think that he had watched my DraftKings account and had me pegged as a suboptimal player, Calvert said. I felt like a moron. So this guy who works for DraftKings is using information about how you play and then challenging you to play over on FanDuel with all kinds of information that you don't know that he has. So I guess what I'm wondering, Sarah, could any of that amount to an argument for somebody who was really on the losing end of this? I mean, I assume there will be lawsuits at some point for people who racked up big debts at one of these sites. Is the fact that not everything is properly disclosed, is that any kind of argument for them?
My understanding is a couple of suits have been filed already. I don't know exactly what the claims were. I think it's just common sense that if someone knows more than you do and they're luring you into play and asking you to use your credit card and then not offering you a fair chance at winning, sure, there's got to be, you know, the uneven playing field. It sounds a lot like a lot of other corporate behavior in this country, doesn't it? I mean, one of the things you were talking about is, you know, when someone has more information than the person playing, reminds me of when Goldman Sachs was exposed for trading ahead of its own clients, so that you'd put in an order, they'd put in the order, it would drive the price up a little bit, so it would cost the client more, but Goldman wins because they've driven the their own clients' desire for the stock has driven the price up. So, I mean, it's paralleled all over the place. We can talk about the mortgage industry. You know, don't get me started.
We only have a minute or two left, but Diana Moskovitz, you know, as we look back to D.C. where you were studying how all this got legalized back in 2006, you know, there are some people coming forward saying, well, we've got to regulate this better. We've got to do a better job with this. But competing against them are all other members of Congress who are essentially advocating the interests of the gaming industry, the people who kind of got locked out of sports betting. So one, a congressman from New Jersey right now is mad because a federal appeals court told New Jersey it couldn't legalize online sports betting, the old kind, the bad kind. And he's saying, well, that's not fair. You know, the NFL gets to have fantasy football. It seems like an unlikely climate in which better outcomes can happen, even if people get really outraged about what we're talking about today. What's your take on that?
Yeah, I mean, my take is I'm still not sure that we can expect any significant change out of Washington anytime soon. You know, when I was looking through a lot of the write-ups about this, I was reading lots of cynical quotes from people about, well, you know, the NFL gets what it wants. It's the folks with billions of dollars, and they've got their own PAC now. They spend tons and tons of money on multiple lobbyists, and it's hard to see that budging right now, I'm afraid. You never know. Maybe I'll be proven wrong. I'm completely open to being proven wrong. But at the end of the day, and now with all the sports leagues involved, you're taking on the NFL, you're taking on baseball, you're taking on NBA, you're taking on NHL, and you're basically asking them to walk away from a lot of money at this point, and that's no small task.
All right, they don't like to do that. Diana Moskovitz from Deadspin, thanks so much. Thanks to Sarah Porras. Here come some nice people to ask you to support our station. All right, usually at this point in the show, Kion Wolf thanks everybody who helped out today, but she's not here, so I have to do this for – I hate having to do things for myself, but I see Betsy Kaplan's on the board for us. I see that Tucker Ives is the producer. I think I see Amanda Gallagher in there handling – yeah, that looks like her – handling the phones right now, and thanks to everybody else who helped out today as well. All right, so see, I never know how much public radio listeners know about sports, you know, like how many things you have to explain to them. So the Mets and the Dodgers are both Major League Baseball teams. They're playing in the National League playoffs right now. On Saturday, there was a play involving a base runner from the Dodgers named Chase Utley and an infielder, a shortstop for the Mets named Ruben Tejada, that has become very controversial. Chase Utley did something that is probably illegal in baseball, and I'm actually trying to think of sports where you can do that. Where it's not, I mean, at minimum, it's frowned on in football to launch yourself at somebody's legs like that. And it may even be illegal. I'm trying to think, there aren't too many, it's not legal in soccer. You can't do that. Not the way that he did it. But it's almost definitely a problem in baseball. Joining us right now is Will Leach, one of our favorite guys covering sports, senior writer for Sports on Earth, founder of Deadspin. We just talked to Diana Moskovitz from Deadspin. And these days, Will also has what sounds like a dream job, which is covering the cultural component of the presidential campaigns for Bloomberg politics. Will, that's got to be a great job.
Oh, I've never covered a presidential election before, so to cover it through the eyes of the way people talk about it on talk shows and the way the Saturday Night Live has it, it's certainly a fun way to do it. Everyone thought it was going to be a quiet year, and someone kind of showed up and made it into kind of a crazy cycle. It's fun to be. I never imagined myself being on the Trump beat, but here I am.
Yeah, some people would argue that you still haven't covered a presidential election.
Yes,
you've covered whatever it is that's going on right now. Not quite a presidential election. So on Saturday in this game between the Mets and the Dodgers, it's a very common play, obviously, trying to break up a double play. A base runner comes in, slides in such a way as to make it difficult for the second baseman or shortstop to relay the throw over to first base. This goes on all the time. So what did Chase Utley do that's so different from what most people do?
Well, I mean, there are two views on this. One is that Utley came in unusually hard, purposely trying to hurt Ruben Tejada and basically doing something, a dirty play is the way people usually refer to it. That is one view. My view is certainly I think the play is ugly, and certainly it's not what you'd like to see, and it seems like something that should not be in baseball. The one thing it is definitely not is unusual. To me, the unusual thing about this is comment happens all the time in baseball. It will happen. And if it doesn't happen in today's game you're watching, it'll happen tomorrow. People always take out the shortstop for the second baseman on that play. And I think it's ugly that they do it, but they certainly do it. The thing that was different about this play was that Ruben Tejada got hurt.
Right.
There was Ruben Tejada. He broke his leg on the play, and it switched the whole momentum in the game and gave the Mets – basically, the Mets were ahead going into the inning, and after that, the Dodgers came back and ended up ultimately winning the game. One of the reasons that I am very wary of the suspension that Major League Baseball put down on Chase Utley is not that I think this is okay. You know, this is a kind of a complicated issue because, you know, it's not okay. Like, it's not okay that we've just accepted in baseball that you can just take out a defensive guy for just because he's there, which is something that it's not okay that happens. But it has been common in baseball for 100 years. And so the idea that just now Chase Utley would be suspended for it, and he's on appeal, it does look like he is going to play tonight, but he is – the fact that you would suspend him for that, to me, speaks less to saying what we want to punish him and more reacting to public outrage and public outcry rather than sticking to a long-time policy on this, which, frankly, is the type of thing that has gotten the NFL in so much trouble over the last year. So I think that's what's different about this. Certainly it's not something you want to be on the side of, yeah, that's okay, Chase Utley, go ahead. I think it's a little bit more complicated than saying, don't let the bag man play.
Right. I have a lot of questions about this, and perhaps you have questions and comments, too, out there if you want to call in at 860-275-7266. I'll try to sound more like Mike Lupica when you do. 860-275-7266, or you can tweet us at WNPRColin. So, Will, it seems to me that really almost nobody not named Chase Utley really wants Chase Utley to play in these next couple of games, and maybe some Dodgers fans, but maybe not the Dodgers themselves. This guy's 37 years old. He's kind of on the downside of what's been a great career, but a great career characterized by the kinds of aggression and aggressive play that we're talking about. But it's such a tense situation. They're adding security at Citi Field tonight because New York fans are just in a state of uncontrolled rage, even for New York sports fans, about this. I mean, in a way, yeah, the suspension is probably let's respond to fan pressure and fan outrage and media outrage and let's get the bad man out of the picture. But it's also, I mean, there's some very practical reasons not to want Chase Utley to play tonight, which is that people are not in a good place about this.
Yeah, but I mean, frankly, that's not Chase Utley's problem, and that's not the Los Angeles Dodgers' problem either. You know, this is the playoffs, and Chase Utley certainly is not necessarily a starter for the Dodgers, but for what it's worth, he actually has always hit Matt Harvey, tonight's Game 3 starter, very well. And certainly you can make an argument if this would have not happened on Tuesday. The lineups have not been announced for the game yet, but if this had not happened, Utley's probably in the starting lineup against Harvey. Maybe he still will be. So, you know, on one hand, yeah, you can say, you know, it's a bad situation. Mets fans are acting up. They're very angry. There's a lot of frustration. Utley has a history with the Mets even before this series. So, though, certainly I understand that. But this isn't being couched as a public safety aspect. This is being couched as a Chase Utley has been suspended for two games because of what he did. And to me, again, it's a hard line to run because you don't want to say it's okay for him to do that. But the idea is that this is a punishment for an aberration, as if he is a rogue agent out there doing this thing that no one's ever seen before. To me, it speaks more to public relations than it does. And I get it. It's going to be a scary situation. A lot of people are concerned about it. But for crying out loud, you know, I mean, it's the problem of Major League Baseball to be able to, and the New York Mets, to make sure that it's a safe place for Chase Utley to play.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean you suspend him so he doesn't play.
Mr. Met, the team's mascot, will be in restraints tonight, I've been told.
Of course. He usually is. Yeah. They usually don't let him out until right. In the second inning.
Yeah, he shouldn't be allowed to roam free. So, you know, just to sort of focus on this for a second. So the situation we have is, as you said, the initial plan was a two-game suspension. Because he can appeal that, that means that he plays tonight. So the next thing that happens, Will, is that, and for people unfamiliar with baseball, the umpires have to make a decision. Do they warn each team at the beginning of the game tonight about how they're going to handle instances of perceived retaliation. The next move would, in fact, sort of go in the normal course of these things. The next move might go over to the Mets and their starter Matt Harvey. He might, in fact, retaliate in some way, particularly if Chase Utley's up there with a bat in his hands. On the other hand, it seems like the Mets could be doubly punished here. Not only have they lost their starting shortstop to a broken leg, but they might be told, well, you know, also, we really don't want your starting pitcher to pitch inside very much, which is, you know, which basically ties the hands of the pitcher and creates yet another disadvantage for the Mets.
On one hand, yes, I agree with that. And if you go with the assumption that warning both pinches means that Matt Harvey won't be able to throw inside, I'm not sure that's quite the case. I think it's really going to be if Chase Utley's up, they're going to throw at him. You know, I don't think there's any idea. I certainly have not gotten the impression that there's other Dodgers the Mets will throw at to retaliate. This also, if you take a step back from this for the record, let's think about the weirdness of this notion in the first place. No place else. We talk about no place else in the history of no other sport are someone just allowed to take out someone like that. Find me another instance in the world, sports or otherwise, where if you're angry at someone, it's perfectly acceptable to throw a rock as hard as you can at them. You know, that's another issue. The beanball idea of baseball is also something that frankly feels a little outdated for the game, and it's another example of the game not being able to police itself. If Matt Harvey throws and hits someone with a pitch tonight, it doesn't mean Matt Harvey's a bad person. It means that everyone has just all kind of accepted that this is an okay thing in baseball to have happen. And so to me, this actually ties in a little bit with that same notion of allowing this play to happen. And there are things in baseball that are brutal and not part of the game at all that they have been successful in getting out of the game. The best example of this are home plate collisions. Famously, you know, the Pete Rose running into Ray Fosse at home plate during the All-Star game in the 70s. You don't see that in baseball anymore because what happened was Buster Posey, a player for the Giants, broke his leg on a play at home plate. And so baseball came out and said, okay, we're going to do what we can to stop this. And they changed the rules of the game. For me, that is what that's what you do with the Chase Utley situation. And maybe someday that's something you do with baseball, with brawling and throwing baseballs at guys. But sure, I suppose that puts Harvey in a bad situation, in a slightly tougher situation. But frankly, Matt Harvey, you know, generally speaking, you talk to players, they don't really think that, like, the control of these pitchers is so good that not being able to throw inside, umpires understand that if a guy gets nicked on the arm or if there's an inside pitch, this is not throwing at them in a lot of ways. And I think that's the concern. I think that's a concern, basically saying, yeah, that's not really fair to the Mets. But also, it also seems a way of endorsing, go ahead and throw a rock at this guy to retaliate, which seems to be a strange way to resolve the situation.
We're talking to Will Leach right now. I like to read him on Bloomberg News these days, where he's, or Bloomberg Politics, where he's covering the cultural aspect of the culture of the political presidential campaign. But he's also a terrific writer and commenter on sports. I feel like a real sports talk show now. We've got Tom from Wallingford on the line. Tom, what do you want to say?
Hey, I've been a baseball fan since as long as I can remember. I'm 56 years old now, and I can remember a time when Bob Gibson actually got a home run hit off him by Manny Minoso. He didn't get a chance to face Minoso again in his career. In an old-timers game about 15 years after, he hit Minoso. Right? We've turned this game into something completely different. When you look at the play, and Utley comes across the bag, there's no God-given right to get a double play there. If the shortstop thought there was some danger, he could have just stepped aside. Right? He had a choice to do that. He wouldn't have gotten hurt. So if the person who's coming across the bag comes across hard and the shortstop doesn't want to risk getting hurt, just step away and say, I'll only take one out.
Well, you know, you bring up an interesting thing or a place I wanted to go. Okay, so Will Leach, there's another thing called the neighborhood play, right, or the neighborhood rule, which in the past said if that shortstop or second baseman was kind of in the neighborhood of the bag, they'd record that as an out. The umpires would make some allowances, particularly if he was doing that to save his own life as somebody came sliding in their spikes up. And I'm wondering, did the neighborhood rule get eroded a little bit because of video replay and video review of plays? Because a weird thing that happened that not too many people have mentioned is that after Ruben Tejada broke his leg, the Dodgers manager came out. I mean, they may not have known that his leg was broken at that point and said, you know, I'm not really sure he even touched the bag. And I'm wondering whether video review is making it also kind of less safe because infielders feel like they've got to hang right in there and have their foot on the bag.
Yeah, this actually speaks to the caller's point a little bit in that this was not actually a double play. In fact, if it would have been, if they would have judged that they would have seen this as him going for a double play, the neighborhood play would have been in effect. That's the way the neighborhood play works, is that if you are going toward first and to get in order to get out of the way, you are able to be near the bag but not actually touch the bag, and they'll still call the out. The neighborhood play is an exception to the replay rule. The difference in this play was it was judged by the umpires that this was, in fact, not a double play situation but a force-out situation. Therefore, he actually did need to touch the bag because he had not even had a chance to make a movement toward first base, thus not part of the neighborhood play. Now, this is doubly unfortunate for the Mets and doubly unfortunate to this whole play, why this whole play is ridiculous in the first place. Because now, imagine if part of the rule at first base were, okay, on a close play, you can take out the first baseman, which is basically the way this play was called. The idea that because it's a force out, because they did not call the neighborhood play, therefore making this just a force out at second base, this gave Chase Utley the opportunity to take out the first baseman, essentially, on a force out play. That's why, to me, we can talk about tough guys and Bob Gibson and being able to throw at these guys all you want, but, you know, that's not actually what baseball is. Like, I know we like to claim that it is because we all feel like we were older and tough guys back in the day, but, like, you know, you look at the way things are. Bob Gibson maybe reached 100 a couple of times in his career and was considered the hardest throwing pitcher in all of baseball. Now, like, every guy's got three or four, every team's got three or four guys who throw 100 miles an hour. And, you know, so for me, the idea of the safety aspect of this is not just the old days where you plunk a guy because he dug in too much on you. This is a higher, frankly, a gameplay at a higher, more dangerous level than it used to be. And I think we like to pretend that things were tougher back then, but I suspect if everybody was throwing 100 miles an hour and coming in to throw one inning at one guy in the seventh or eighth inning, we might feel different about how the tough guy aspect of it.
Well, Will Leach, as usual, you are our go-to guy for something like this. You're our closer. You're the guy with a 100-mile-per-hour sports opinion. Thanks to everybody who helped out with today's show, especially to Will for joining us on short notice, and we'll be back tomorrow with a very different set of topics. Yeah.